to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 22, The British Triumvirate. So before we get started this week, I just want to apologize for the delay in this episode. I know that I was planning to get one out before I went back home to New York, and then I went back home to New York for my spring break, and after a slight case of food poisoning, and then coming back and being bogged down with having to create my finals for my classes and making sure my seniors all graduate, and the long, daunting task that it is to be a world language teacher, well, I was just very tired. That's plain and simple. But the finals are made. The seniors are finished. Now all I have to do is worry about my underclassmen, and they will be taken care of this week. I have the finals ready to go. When the finals are done, I have summer vacation. I'm a very excited man. I'm not going to lie. What teacher isn't excited about summer vacation? So, this British triumvirate. Before we get into these three generals, we're going to take a short time to have a review. So, we've talked about the taxes and how they made the colonists upset. There's a massacre. The colonists are now at a breaking point. We have ourselves a little tea party. The British are closing ports. So, what happens? Everything boils up. And then we have the fight at Lexington and Concord. Lexington and Concord was the first example of how the Americans can stand up to a British army, maybe not fight on British terms, but they'll be able to bring a fight to a British army on land. Then we talked about this brief little incident up in Maine. We talked about how not only can this rabble of colonists bring a fight to a British army on land, but they're also able to do it on the sea. Now, the Margaretta was no pitched naval battle. There was a brief exchange of gunfire, a small gunboat versus a couple of fishing vessels. I mean, we're not talking about the Battle of Midway here, but it's still a point that the British have to raise an eyebrow to. These colonists are good sailors, and if they're able to figure out tactics around the British Navy and able to capture a Navy vessel, well, what's stopping them from getting a few more fishing boats together and attacking and capturing frigates? You know, you get a couple of sloops and frigates captured. Now you can capture a man of war. And if they've captured a British man of war, the British have something to be really embarrassed about. So needless to say, the hits just keep on coming for Parliament. It's becoming frustrating with the state of affairs in the American colonies. And Gage has not been able to stop the rebellion. And so in early 1775, he asks for 20,000 more men. He says, I need to crush this rebellion. And I can do it if you give me the men. Instead, he's given one regiment of light dragoons, about three regiments of infantry, and about 700 marines. All in all, somewhere in the vicinity of about 5,000 men, including officers. But there's something else that the British send. Instead of 15,000 men, they send three generals: William Howe, John Burgoyne, and Henry Clinton. Now, if you're sitting there hearing this and saying, well, if that just isn't a major red flag to Thomas Gage, well, it was. You see, Parliament had lost faith in him. And so now they're going to send their three best land generals to take over and put down this rebellion. On April 20th, 1775, around about the same time that the last of the British soldiers have been able to get back to their barracks and put their heads down after a long night and a long day of fighting from Concord, three generals board the frigate called Cerberus, heading for Boston. Now, for those of you who are caught up on your Greek mythology, Cerberus was the three-headed hellhound that guarded the gates of Tartarus, the underworld, the realm of Hades. So if this wasn't another ominous omen that this three-headed monster was coming for America, well, it would just seem that the Americans were going to need their Hercules to defeat it. So the first general I'm going to talk about is one that little is known about, but he'll also be in the colonies during the war the longest, and that's Henry Clinton. Born April 16, 1730, little is known about the general in his early life, but we do know that his father was George Clinton. No, not the Rastafarian funk singer, but an admiral in the British Navy. And his mother, Anne Carl, was the daughter of a general. So with that pedigree, it's no wonder that he joined the military. George Clinton was appointed governor of Newfoundland, so the family spent a long time in the American colonies. And in 1756, when his term ended, George Clinton bought Henry a position as aide to Sir John Ligonier. I am very sketchy on the pronunciation of that, so I apologize if I pronounced it wrong. During the Seven Years' War, Henry rose through the ranks to lieutenant colonel. And in 1760, he is sent to Europe and is wounded in battle. For his bravery, he garners some notoriety and a promotion to colonel. Now, we won't take away the fact that Henry Clinton was a very successful general in the battlefield. But knowing what we know about a lot of other British generals, it's a bit of a surprise that this man was more known for his shy, quiet, reserved attributes than his notoriety in battle. His contemporaries, and even himself, would say that he's a quote-unquote shy bitch. Now, Henry's personal life is, for what we do know, filled with tragedy. Henry's father dies, leaving him to settle up the family debts. He tries to sell some of the family land in America, but is unable to do so. And unfortunately, that land will get confiscated in the Revolution anyway. His mother will die a few years later, and his wife will die giving birth to their fifth child. But, once again, his notoriety from his battlefield prowess, he earns himself not only the rank of Major General, but a seat in the British Parliament. Now, the second general we're going to mention is, well, the exact opposite of George Clinton in most ways. You see, John Burgoyne was boisterous, outgoing, definitely a big talker, and we're going to see how sometimes during the Revolution, that big mouth of his, well, that will just get him into a lot of trouble. John Burgoyne was a bit of a, what I like to say, a peacock. He likes to puff up and show his beautiful plumage. So much so that he earned himself the nickname Gentleman Johnny. Born February 24th, 1723, in Sutton, Bedfordshire, England, he was the firstborn son of a army captain, John Burgoyne, and his wife, Anna Maria. John Jr. was educated at Westminster in 1733. It's there that he befriends a young Thomas Gage and a Lord James Strange, his future brother-in-law. When he's 15 years old, Burgoyne will purchase his first commission. It's in the Horse Guards. He became known for his keen fashion sense that earned him that nickname of Gentleman Johnny. But unfortunately, the good general was a bit of a gambler, too. And in 1741, he's going to have to sell his first commission to pay off his debts. When Britain became involved in the War of Austrian Succession, Burgoyne will purchase a coronet's commission. This is similar to the rank of second lieutenant. And he returns to the army in the 1st Royal Dragoons. He's quickly promoted to the rank of lieutenant, and by the year's end, he's a captain. It was around this time that he began to court Lady Charlotte Stanley. This is the sister of his friend James Strange. Their father, the 11th Earl of Derby, however, refused to allow Charlotte to marry Burgoyne. So instead, the couple eloped. In April of 1751, they will make their way to France. Burgoyne is in debt again, and he wants to escape his creditors. He's had to sell his commission for a second time to pay off some of his gambling debts. For several years, the couple will travel around France. Burgoyne will attend several French schools, and he will get himself an education while they are in a self-imposed exile from their home country. But with some negotiation through his friend James Strange, the couple will be able to reconcile with their Earl, and the family will be whole once again. Lord Derby will use his influence to get Burgoyne another commission, this time as a captain, in the 11th Dragoons. During the Seven Years' War, Burgoyne took part in several raids on the French coast, capturing the town of Cherbourg, and in May 1759, he was made a captain lieutenant. This is basically the rank in between captain and lieutenant of the Coldstream Guards, the oldest regiment in the British Army, and probably one of the most well-known. It still is in existence today. He sees great success in the war, reaching the rank of brigadier general, and returns home a war hero. Upon his return, he has earned himself a seat in Parliament, and in May 1772, he is promoted to major general. And on that April morning of 1775, a mere 3 years after his promotion, he will board the frigate bound for Boston, the second head of Cerberus. Now, the last general that we're going to talk about, and this is going to be a bit of a spoiler alert, he will become commander-in-chief of British forces on the American continent during the first half of the war, is, of course, William Howe. Not only is he well-known to those that study the American Revolution, but he's also well-known to those that study British military history. He's probably one of the greatest field commanders that the British will ever produce during this period of their history. Now, William Howe is born August 10th, 1729, to Emmanuel and Charlotte Howe. William is the third of four sons. His eldest brother, George, is actually killed during the French and Indian War. His brother, Richard, is an admiral in the Royal Navy, and his youngest brother, Thomas, commands ships for the East India Company. The Howes were quite the military family during the 1700s. Now, this is a little-known fact that I feel a lot of people are surprised by, but the Howes were actually cousins of King George III. It's an interesting little story. You see, William's grandmother was a lover of King George I, King George III's grandfather. And from this came Emmanuel, William's father. And obviously, King George I birthed King George II, so the two men were actually half-brothers. And being that Emmanuel and George both had sons, one being King of England, the other one being their great field commander, these two men were cousins. So if you can follow that weird warped family tree, the Howes and King George were cousins. Now, when Howe was 17, he joined the military like his two older brothers. And by following year, he was made a lieutenant. And by the time he was 21, he was made a captain. At the start of the French and Indian War, there was a need for good officers. William won many battles on the European continent and the respect and admiration of his army friends. When his brother George is killed, William took up his seat in Parliament. In 1759, Howe will travel to the colonies, and he's going to join the attack on Quebec. The attack is led by his old friend, General James Wolfe. Now, unfortunately for the British, Wolfe is killed in the battle. So where Wolfe will be remembered, Captain Howe, well, his star is on the rise. Howe was promoted to lieutenant colonel, and by the following spring, he is returned to London. In 1764, he is again promoted. This time, he's made colonel of a regiment that is being sent to Ireland. Howe will spend 4 years there, until 1768, when he's made governor of the Isle of Wight. And in 1772, in recognition of his service and command skills, Howe was made a major general. And he's given a new command. This time, he's given command of the training and overseeing the organization of light infantry. This was a post he happily accepted. Known during his time in Parliament as an advocate for the American colonies, he saw the intolerable acts as unjust and argued against them in the House. He believed that the acts would ignite a war with the colonies and did not like the thought of fighting fellow Englishmen. Do you think he had a crystal ball underneath those robes that they wear? Or was it just that blatantly obvious to right-thinking Parliament members that if you keep doing what you're doing, the colonists are going to revolt? I don't know, but I digress. Unfortunately, war came nonetheless, and like the other two, Howe boards the Cerberus as the last head of the mythical dog. By the time the triumvirate would arrive in June of 1775, they had not had any fresh intelligence of the situation in Massachusetts for over 4 months. And in Howe's opinion, Gage's handling of the situation was poorly executed. Boston was at the center of the revolution, and he thought it folly to think that he could ever bring Boston back into the fold. Boston was going to have to come in by force. But with the colonists surrounding the city on the high ground outside of the Boston city center, and the British Navy could do little to drive them off the hilltops because they were out of range of their guns. So something had to be done. Howe's thought was that they should shift their view to the Hudson and Connecticut rivers. You see, New York was more central. It had access to the interior without having to go through the narrow neck of Boston. The fact that Manhattan itself was a more popular loyalist city, it seemed that New York was the place to go. Another thing the ministers in London wanted to assess was the army strength. Was it going to be enough to put the colonies back under control? You see, the ministers in Parliament all thought that Gage was just overestimating the numbers, and that the 7,000 or so redcoats that were available in Boston should be more than enough to drive off the patriots that are up on the hill without much trouble at all. And Howe would concur with Gage. You see, he felt that the situation called for 20,000 more men, and Parliament was shocked. They were not prepared for Howe to be like, no, Gage is right, he is stuck, and the Massachusetts militia is itching for a fight. We need more men. Howe requested that 19,000 troops be sent to reinforce the British Army in America. They wanted to overwhelm the Americans and restore peace quickly. Howe knew that if you gave the Americans any time and any traction to dig in or to organize themselves, that it was going to be very difficult to restore peace and to do it without a lot of bloodshed. Gage has one last attempt to get control of Boston and put the colonies back together. And he's going to make a move that he's going to try and break the siege by moving against the town of Charlestown. Now, if you're looking at a map of Boston and an older map from the Revolutionary period, you will see that Charlestown is just to the north, separated by a narrow inlet. Today, Charlestown is a neighborhood of Boston. It has been brought into the overall metropolitan city of Boston. But back then, it was a small fishing town just north of the larger city, and it had two hills that overlooked the city, Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill. It's here that Gage is going to try and break the siege and regain control of the American colonies. So that's where we're going to leave it for this week. I will be back next week. I will have a fresh episode. And of course, with that lead-in, the fresh episode is going to be Bunker Hill. I guess we could call this episode not only a lead-in to Bunker Hill, but also a character study on three of some of the more prominent British generals. Now, the way I did it this week is I wanted to leave off right to where they step off the boat and are in Boston. I didn't want to spoil too much of the story and say where they end up throughout the war years, and I also didn't want to waste three separate episodes talking about three separate generals. I figure that we could just easily flow with these three generals into talking about the Siege of Boston and how Gage was going to break the siege and where we end up with the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now, I'm going to bring back the book recommendation, and I have a great recommendation this week. It talks mostly about the topic that we are going to discuss in next week's episode, but there is a good deal talking about our three generals. And the book I've chosen is With Fire and Sword. This is done by James L. Nelson, and this is not going to be this is the first book I've recommended by him, but it is definitely not going to be the last. He writes several great books about non-popular time periods of the war. Now, Bunker Hill, yes, Bunker Hill is very famous, but he does another book that we're going to talk about in a future episode that I absolutely love. It's probably one of my favorites by him. He's actually a very big Benedict Arnold historian, so when we get to talking about Benedict Arnold, he will come up as places where I have cited information from. So this week's recommendation is With Fire and Sword by James L. Nelson. That's going to do it for this week. I hope everyone is enjoying their Memorial Day, as I'm recording this on Memorial Day. I'm going to bring back the Facebook. I'm going to really spend a lot of time working on it. I have gone on a lot of Revolutionary War geared trips, so I want to add some stuff in there. I also want to make sure that everyone knows that you can ask me questions on there. If you have any questions about the American Revolution and you want to know some things, that the Facebook is the way to do it. So I'm going to get back into that once school is done in the next 2 weeks, and we will be back and rolling with a fully set up and ready to go podcast. So everyone have a great Memorial Day, have a great week, and as always, keep your powder dry.